a great big glass of wine.
Many of us like to kick back and enjoy a glass of wine, a cocktail, or a local microbrew from time to time. But how often do we stop to think about the science that went into making that drink? We'll get into the science this hour with the author of Proof, The Science of Booze. Good morning, I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. So pull up a stool, pour yourself an Irish coffee if that's what you'd like, and join in with your questions about what goes into your favorite libation, how it's made, how it makes you feel. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is Adam Rogers. He is articles editor for Wired and author of Proof, The Science of Booze. Good morning.
Good morning.
So have you been known to like to knock back a cocktail or two?
I can't believe you just suggested Irish coffee.
Why not? It's morning.
Oh, man. I just had that my stomach actually tightened a little bit. Like, I'm waking up to an Irish coffee. They're a little sweet for the morning for me.
I was thinking coffee. You know, how about a Bloody Mary? Would you like one of those?
You know, it's weird. There actually used to be pre-Prohibition and Prohibition era. There was an entire class of cocktails called the pick-me-up that were designed for drinking in the morning, because the assumption was that you'd been drinking all night and so you were hungover. So you were gonna. This is what you're supposed to drink to feel better. You don't see them very much anymore. There's the Bloody Family and like there's a Mimosa. That's sort of our version of it now. But my favorite was a drink called the Corpse Reviver Number 2.
Survivor?
The Corpse Reviver, which is a great name, right? And people, you can get it in some bars that are interested in historic cocktails now. It's very tasty. It's gin-based. But people tend to think it's like a zombie reference or something. But, of course, the corpse in the name of it is you, right? You're so destroyed in the morning that you need a drink to make it through the...
Well, we might be getting ahead of ourselves, but now I'm curious. Is there any science behind the hair of the dog theory?
Yeah, no, it's a fascinating question. I mean, nobody's ever really proved that hair of the dog is a good treatment for a hangover. It does relieve some symptoms, right? And there's a notion that could be because the ethanol in the drink, which is the alcohol that we drink that makes us feel the way it does, is displacing methanol, which is the toxic stuff. Like if you that whole thing about like if you drink really bad moonshine, you go blind. That would be because of methanol, a different kind of alcohol, and there are minute traces of it in anything that we drink. And the idea is maybe those are what causes the hangover. And the way you deal with methanol toxicity is you administer ethanol because of the way the enzyme that breaks down alcohol in our body works. And so maybe that's why hair of the dog works. But that's it's so unproven, and it's really a bad idea to have another drink in the morning. It's the one thing. People who do that tend to also be the ones who become alcoholic later.
Yeah. Well, let's start at the beginning and talk about how who figured out that I don't know that you could drink anything, you know, like Irish coffee or a Bloody Mary or anything else for that matter, and that it would make him feel good.
And who's the genius?
Yeah.
Who do we owe the IP? The rights to, you know, nobody actually knows who the first human was, and there you can get sort of evolutionary just so stories about whether or not our non-human primate ancestors liked to seek out fermented fruit. But the oldest evidence of human beings controlling fermentation to make something to drink is about 9 or 10,000 years old. It comes from an archaeological site in China called Jiahu, which is a fascinating site. It's also one of the places with the oldest evidence of musical instruments and the oldest evidence of written language. And it comes from a shard of pottery that a researcher named Patrick McGovern did a lot of analytical chemistry on, basically. And he found residue of beeswax, which you would only find if there was honey, of rice, and then of tartaric acid, which usually would be grapes, but from that period in China was probably hawthorn fruit. You don't find ethanol because ethanol is evanescent, right? It's volatile. It evaporates, goes away. But he says, rightly, I think, that if you mix those things together, you have a hard time not letting them ferment. You know, like, and there's only really one reason to mix them together, which would be to try to make a fermented drink. So it's sort of to him, that's the mother Eve of booze, right? Because honey is what would make mead, rice makes sake, fruit makes wine and brandy. So this is that's the oldest one. And you know, that period of time, that 9 or 10,000 years ago, puts it right at the beginning of human civilization. It puts it right when Homo sapiens is becoming people, you know, when we're starting to settle down and make farms and make cities. So it's right when we started becoming who we are today. Yes. Part of that process.
It's been with us forever, and for the most part, it's a beverage that we enjoy all over the world.
Yeah, you know, there are cultures certainly that don't partake for you know, often for religious reasons, but basically anywhere you go in the world, there's a culture that makes something alcoholic. I mean, you know, you can go as far as the Asian steppes and find people drinking kumis, which is fermented mare's milk. You know, if there's a place to find a sugar source, we find a way to ferment it.
Well, let's talk about what goes into that fermentation. What's needed for fermentation?
Well, really all you need are yeast, right, which is just a fungus that knows how to eat sugar and excrete carbon dioxide and ethanol. And then you need a sugar source. And that sugar source can be, you know, most obviously something like fruit, for example, or honey, which is very high in the kind of simple sugar that yeast can digest. And then the one that probably we're most familiar with in the States, other than grapes for wine, would be grain, right? Now, grain's a little more complicated because grain doesn't really have simple sugars. It has simple sugars kind of connected together into bigger molecules, which we would call starches, right? That's how grains store their sugars. So we have to figure out a way to convert those starches into sugars that the yeast can then eat. And for us, that's a process called malting, which causes there to be enzymes inside the grains that break down starch into sugars. And that's what makes beer possible. Beer and whiskey is basically just fermented beer, so that's where we get that. In the East, if they're making sake or, you know, rice wines, they have a whole other process for converting the starch in rice. Uses another fungus, a really interesting one called koji. But basically, you've got to get those starches turned into sugars. You feed those to the yeast, and happy yeast give you booze.
So is this this happy yeast is in all spirits and beer and wine? I mean, it's all the same process.
Yeah, it's everything. And in fact, that process is the fact that it's that same process is kind of what got me going on the book in terms of a structure for it. Because, you know, most people when they think about, I don't know about most people, I may be my impression of how people think about booze may be a little bit exaggerated, so sorry, but when people think about booze, they tend to think about categories, right? So you think like, oh, we'll talk about beer, or we'll talk about tequila, or we'll talk about rum, we'll talk about wine, and that's a heuristic, right? It's a way to organize your thinking, and that's a perfectly good one. But I got interested in the arc, you know, the fact that anything that we drink has to follow this process from yeast to sugar to fermentation to distillation, and then maybe to aging it in barrel, and then to drinking it. Smelling, tasting it, and then the effect it has on the body. And that's true across the world, across time, and across whatever you're drinking. So just as an example, right, if you take yeast for a second, then you think about grapes or grape juice, right? If you ferment that, you get wine. If you distill that, you get what you would think of as an unaged brandy, an eau de vie, or like something like Pisco, right, which is a South American unaged brandy. And then if you age that, you would get something like a cognac or an Armagnac, that beautiful brown amber stuff, and then you have to drink it, right? But that's true for that, you know, that walks you through grapes, but you could do the same kind of process for agave and pulque and tequila, or for grain and beer and whiskey. You know, those are the same, it's the same arc with variations in ingredients and variations in process and variations in the shape of the still, or variations in temperatures and times for fermentation. All that stuff changes, but the fundamentals of the process don't.
Interesting, and you know, if I'm not mistaken, there's a local winery in the area that is well known for its fine wines. But it also now started making brandy. And so I thought, so that's one of the, I mean, it was a winery that makes brandy doesn't probably surprise you.
No, not at all. And you know, it makes a lot of sense because what you're doing is, through that process, just to be cold and economic about it, it's still a science, even though they call it the dismal science, right? If you have the stuff, you have the materials, it's not much more, it's not a big jump, right, to take that wine that you've been making all along, buy yourself a still or contract to a local still and say, listen, we have this wine. Could you run it through and let's see what shows? You do have to wait. If you're making Western-style brandy, you got to put some age on it. And that's the thing that costs producers the most. It's the big barrier to entry for a small craft distillery. It's like, okay, we made our stuff. Now we wait 10 years until we can sell it. Where do we keep it? You know, and you can imagine that's pretty tough if you're doing a startup.
Talk some about that. Does it matter what our booze is aged in?
Yeah, it really does. This fascinates me because this is chemistry that's not well understood yet. People are doing this research right now. But most of the time, if you're making a spirit that people know the name of, there are rules set by the law or by the governing body of that spirit that say, well, you have to do it a certain way. And so usually what they're aging in barrels is they're barrels made of oak, right? And so, but just to give you an example of what those distinctions are, American whiskey bourbon, if you're making bourbon specifically, one of the rules is it has to be aged in new oak barrels, which is to say barrels that haven't been used to hold anything else, right? But Scotch whiskey, single malt whiskey that's made in Scotland, one of the rules is you have to use old barrels that have been used to age something else. So there is a brisk market in taking the barrels that were used to hold bourbon and shipping them to Scotland so they can use them to age single malt whiskey. And there are a lot of different kinds of oak, right? So the bourbon makers, the big distillers, will use white oak, the particular kind of tree. But there are people doing really interesting experiments with other kinds of wood. And I've tasted booze aged in wood that was a combination, for example, of European oak and American oak versus just American oak.
Mm-hmm.
And you notice a difference in flavor. There's some other molecule in there that has a different aroma that has an effect on the final. And you can buy from some companies like staves or pieces of wood, inserts that you can put into a barrel to try to get a different flavor. So, for example, I tasted some spirit that they'd aged with hickory, and it really did kind of taste barbecue-y.
Really?
You know, like you could perceive that difference in there.
So what's going on chemically inside this barrel of booze? It's absorbing the taste of the wood.
Yeah, well, a couple of things. You know, wood is made of mostly another version of sugar attached together in a different interesting way called cellulose. There's another one called hemicellulose. There's another molecule in there called lignin. And that's primarily what wood is, especially once you've dried it, right? So there's none of the stuff that would be inside a living plant. Now, all of those, the inner layer of that, which is in contact with the liquid, once you touch that with ethanol, which is really good at dissolving other molecules in it, those start to break down into all kinds of weird sugars and aromatic molecules. So a really familiar one would be vanillin, right, the thing that gives us a vanilla flavor. So that's one of the first notes that often people will taste in something that's been aged, right, in a whiskey or in a wine that's been in the barrel for a long time, that little bit of vanilla smell. And then another one there are lactones, which is just a name for a particular kind of molecule. They call them either oak lactones or sometimes whiskey lactones, and that's that kind of coconutty, round, lush mouthfeel that you get sometimes when you taste a single malt or a red wine that spent a lot of time, or when somebody says, like, oh, if you're a white wine drinker, like, oh, it's an over-oaked Chardonnay, right? That's kind of, it's a famous thing that people argue about with white wine. That's that oak flavor. Those are those lactones that you're tasting too much of, kind of buttery almost.
Mm-hmm.
And there's tons of other molecules like that. I mean, this is where you get into the organic chemistry of the wood as in contact with ethanol. Plus, you know, time itself induces chemical changes. So you get oxygen molecules, oxygen atoms attach to some of the molecule, the aromatics that are in that kind of soup, in that liquid that's aging, and they change its character. Esters form, combination of an alcohol and an acid. When they come together, that's called an ester, and those can have certain flavors. Those tend to be the fruity sort of flavors, like that apple or pear flavor that you'll get in a Teenage spirit is usually an ester. And so that's all happening too, and you let that kind of go for 10 years as the weather over the course of the year changes, and when it's hotter, the liquid penetrates further into the wood, and then when it's cooler, it retreats, and it sort of mixes and sits there. And after a while, you end up with something that, if you've done it right, tastes like, 10-year-old Jim Beam or something.
We are talking about the science of booze with Adam Rogers. He is author of the book Proof. And we're welcoming your questions. We're welcoming your own stories about the process of fermentation, distilling, aging of booze. And we are welcoming your questions for Adam at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. We'll also, coming up, talk about how our bodies and our brains respond to booze. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Jack Daniels, oh, number seven, Tennessee style mash whiskey.
We are talking about whiskey and tequila and beer and wine and spirits of all sorts with the author of the new book, Proof, The Science of Booze, Adam Rogers. And we are welcoming your questions about the science behind your preferred adult beverage, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org, or you can post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. So, I was thinking of that song, talking about Jack Daniel's Old Number 7, and I've been seeing some news stories that there's really been a boom in sales globally of booze and whiskey in particular. I think any reason to account for this, Adam?
There has been. It's true. Whiskey, especially, is doing much better than the makers ever expected it would in the East, in China and in India. In part because those are countries that are very, very large and have a burgeoning middle, upper middle, and upper class. So they can finally afford to spend, what can be upwards of $100 on a bottle of something, and they're drinking it as fast as those companies can make it. It's interesting because in those places they'll also have it's a different drinking culture, different rituals. So the single malt makers who have in the past been pretty finicky about the best way to enjoy the thing that they make have had to kind of metabolize the fact that in Japan, for example, the standard way to drink even the most expensive and rare whiskeys is as a shot at the bottom of a glass of seltzer water with ice in it as a highball, which, when they first sort of started telling the whiskey makers that was the way folks were drinking their product, that would earn you a frown and a shudder. I think now that they're selling enough of it that they think, well, hey, people get to enjoy their drink however they want.
What does single malt mean?
Well, so I mentioned that process of taking the starch in a grain and turning it and getting the enzymes to turn that into simple sugars that yeast would like. That process is called malting. You're taking barley and turning it into malted barley, into malt. And it is that flavor of if you get malt, if you get a chocolate malt, right? That stuff. That's what the malt is. It tastes like that. If you eat it just fresh out of the malting, it tastes like a sweetened kid's breakfast cereal or a malt and a chocolate malt. Single malt means that what you're drinking comes from a single distillery. So what you're drinking is not mixed in with the product of another distillery. So they're getting their malt from someplace and they're distilling it there and probably aging it there on that site as well. It's a way to distinguish the whiskey from a blended whiskey, let's say, right? Which is if you get something like Johnny Walker, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or blended Scotch whiskeys, and they'll take hundreds of different single malts and mix those together with a grain spirit, a more neutral tasting one that they can get in bulk. They'll mix those and they do that for consistency. So, Johnny Walker Black tastes like Johnny Walker Black every time, right? And that's really kind of amazing. It's because they're making it from a different product that changes from year to year. But it's because they blend it together, they mix that, and they make it in volume so that you get Johnny Walker Black every time. That's the distinction between a single malt and a blend.
Good. And what exactly is meant by proof?
I'm sorry, say it again?
Proof, the name of the book.
Oh, proof. Proof is the measure on a bottle of how much alcohol there is in a wine or a spirit. So if something is 80 proof, that's 40% alcohol by volume in this country. But it comes from an interesting story, actually. One of the rations that countries used to give their sailors and their navies included rum. They wanted them to have a nice tot before going off to bed any given day. And in the British Navy, before serving the rum ration to sailors, they would mix it with a little bit of gunpowder and set it on fire. And if it caught fire, that meant that the alcohol content in the rum had to be high enough that the sailors would drink it, that it hadn't been watered down, right? The command wasn't trying to cheap out on the ration. So if it did catch fire, that was proof, right, that it was sufficiently high in alcohol. And that word stuck. And also, you know, for the book, it's a little bit of a pun because, of course, proof is what you get when you do science.
Right, exactly. Yeah. We are talking with the author of Proof, The Science of Booze, Adam Rogers, who is also the articles editor for Wired. And we welcome your questions for him, your thoughts about the science behind your cocktail. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org or post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Well, I also wanted to get into the science of what alcohol does to our brains and bodies. How do we know that drinking alcohol will intoxicate us, but exactly what is happening, Adam, inside our bodies?
Well, you know, that is one of those things that is an obvious and super easy question to ask and an amazingly difficult question to answer. One of the things that surprised me the most when I was doing the reporting for this book is that unlike every other recreational drug that human beings take, and regardless of how you feel, you know, morally or legally about that, people take a lot of them, right? Ethanol, alcohol, is the only one that scientists really haven't articulated a mechanism for. They really don't know exactly how it works in our brains. We can tell them a lot about how it makes us feel when we're drinking, but in fact, even that changes from person to person and culture to culture. So at the most basic level, women tolerate alcohol about half as well as men do, even when you account for body mass. And that's probably because of some differences in the enzymes that we make, but still, that's a little bit weird, right?
Mm-hmm.
And kind of a bummer. Or as another example, about a third of people of Asian descent just don't make one of the enzymes that we use to break ethanol down in our bodies, which means that when they have even as much as one drink, they go, in a sense, straight from no drinking to hangover. They get facial flush, their face gets red, they get gastrointestinal problems. They just don't tolerate the stuff. That's a third of people of Asian descent, right, just as a genetic quirk.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens? Well, you know, first we drink it goes through our mouth, it goes into the gut, it goes into our mouth, we're tasting and smelling it. That's where flavor comes from. Because ethanol is a volatile molecule, like I said, because it evaporates very quickly, because it's so small as a molecule relative to others, it carries all kinds of aromas that we wouldn't otherwise perceive up into behind our mouth, up into the nasal epithelium in our nose, basically, which are the way the nose works is essentially you have tendrils of neurons, your nerve endings actually stretch down from your brain down through the back of your nose and into the kind of cavity above your mouth, which is pretty amazing, right? It makes sense, this direct sense. Smell is more direct than any other sense we have. When you smell something, parts of your brain are literally touching pieces of the thing that you are smelling. It's kind of remarkable, right? The environment is coming right into, you know, the environment's coming behind your face, basically. And touching parts of you. It's weird. And nobody really knows how that works in the brain. Nobody really knows how that part of your brain processes those aromatic molecules into what we would consider smell. You know, it's not like the spectrum of the electromagnetic spectrum translating into colors. There's no smell spectrum that people have been able to identify yet. Meanwhile, right, it's in your stomach. It goes in your gut. It moves to organs like the liver and the kidneys and the pancreas. You know, the pancreas is making various enzymes to help digest it. The kidneys are dealing with the fact that alcohol suppresses the antidiuretic hormone, a hormone called vasopressin. And what that usually does is when your body makes it, frankly, it keeps you from peeing too much, right? But when you're drinking, that hormone gets suppressed.
That's why you're peeing too much then.
Exactly, right. Which dehydrates you a bit, changes your electrolyte balance, makes you feel a little bit different, puts your kidneys to work. Your kidneys have to handle that because now all this water is going to be passing through. Right? And meanwhile, your liver is doing a lot of the work to, primarily with an enzyme called alcohol dehydrogenase, with some others, to take that ethanol that you just put into it and extract energy, figure out how to extract energy from it and get the waste products out of your body. But meanwhile, because that can take some time, the ethanol passes into the bloodstream. Ethanol is fat-soluble, which means it goes right through the walls of your cells, which are basically made of fat. And it very quickly crosses the blood-brain barrier, the thing that keeps most stuff circulating in your bloodstream from getting into your brain, and it makes it into your brain. So you start to feel different and think a little bit different. So what's happening in the brain? If you could figure that out, you would win prizes and get grant money.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff. I mean, because it not only does it inebriate you, but then something in some people it causes there's an addiction that's going on too to that that alcohol.
That's right. And so the aspects of binge drinking, of addiction, of dependency on alcohol, that's what most of the money in the U.S. at least goes towards studying in alcohol use and behaviors, and rightly so, right? Because that's the thing that has the most consequences. You know, that's what costs money and lives, basically. It is not what I touch on mostly in the book. My book, sort of metaphorically at least, takes place about two sips into your second round, right? So you feel the effects, you know what it tastes like, you perhaps are enjoying yourself if that is a thing that you enjoy, but you're not, you know, you're not doing something stupid like driving, right? And when, you know, when it's in the brain, what the understanding that researchers are kind of heading toward or trying to get to is, okay, well, we sort of understand that it's ethanol seems to be like an inhibitor of an inhibitor, basically. It tamps down the thing that keeps us from feeling too good or being too excited. So it makes that not happen as much. It's in the right parts of the brain. It seems to have an effect on that, on the neurotransmitter that ordinarily do that. The way the neurons of the brain talk to each other with molecules called neurotransmitters, they don't actually touch each other. They just sort of squirt chemicals at each other to tell each other what to do and what to think next. And ethanol seems to be related to a whole kind of sequence of those neurotransmitters talking one after the other that controls, calibrates, that lets us control ourselves and that keeps us from being too too excited and too happy all the time.
Well, we have some callers that I want to bring into the conversation. Rob in Eau Claire is with us. Hello, Rob.
Hi there. It's a very fascinating discussion, and from the outset, I should say, I'm a Mormon. I don't even drink.
Oh, really?
But I find this very interesting, but my question is mostly linguistic in nature. I was so fascinated by your description of or explanation of the word proof. I'm actually a professor of linguistics, and I'm wondering if you know the evolution of the word booze and of spirits, and booze especially is interesting to me. It seems kind of, it's almost got a pejorative connotation, to my mind anyway. But do you know anything about the evolution of those two words, booze and spirits?
Do you know, I feel like a dope for not looking up the evolution of the word booze, and I will as soon as I'm off the interview. It's a fascinating question. And I'm so glad that you are interested in the subject matter, even though you don't partake yourself, because I tried to write the book in a way that would make this science lively enough that even if somebody wasn't a drinker, that they would be interested in the science. So I'm glad to hear that it's sort of working. I will tell you that on spirits, the one of the notions for the etymology of the word, for the origin of it, is that distillation was a technology that, depending on which account you believe, may well have been invented by ancient alchemists in Alexandria in Egypt, specifically a woman named Maria the Jewess. Don't get mad, I didn't name her, but that's the name that she's written about by hundreds of years later. And Maria was famous for inventing lab equipment, basically. She also invented a double boiler that labs use called the Bain Marie. But what alchemists were doing was they weren't trying to make something to drink, right? They were trying to get at the ineffable, not at that point understandable, spirits that resided in every inanimate thing, right? They wanted to get at the spirits of nature. So what they were making came to be called spirits.
We are talking about spirits and wine and beer and the science that goes into making that cocktail that you enjoy, as well as what alcohol does to our bodies and our brains. We are talking with the author of Proof, The Science of Booze, and we welcome your questions for him. Your thoughts about what it takes to make the perfect adult beverage. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Some little way my body was trying to say that you better stop drinking brandy. In its own little way my body was trying to say that you better stop drinking brandy.
So do you drink brandy? Well, who in Wisconsin doesn't? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking about brandy and other spirits and what it takes to make them, you know, the process it takes from fermentation to distilling to aging. And we are welcoming your questions, your experiences, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Adam Rogers is the author of Proof, The Science of Booze. We drink a lot of brandy in Wisconsin, Adam. Did you come here for any of your research?
I don't think that I did. But now that I know that brandy's a big thing, I'll have to make sure to stop in.
Okay. Harry in Neshota is with us. Hi, Harry.
Hi, good morning. I wanted to ask a little bit about history a little bit earlier in the United States. Here in the upper Midwest, in Wisconsin in particular, there was a lively distilling industry in the mid-1800s with the advent of more and more immigration from Central Europe. And my great-great-grandfather actually was a distiller here in the Milwaukee area. And what would they have been brewing? What was a popular distilled beverage that they would have been making from corn? Because I know my great-great-grandfather grew corn. What in the 1860s, 70s would have been the popular beverage before excise taxes during Reconstruction after the Civil War kind of killed off northern distilling?
Well, if corn is your substrate, you're almost certainly making a whiskey. Now, the interesting question would be whether you were aging it or not, right? Because even as late as the mid-1800s, the rules for whether things had to be aged and how you aged them didn't really exist yet. You tended to age something if you could afford to put it up yourself, or if it was going to be shipped somewhere for a long way and it would get shipped in barrels and it would get some age on it that way. So certainly in the 1820s through the period that you're talking about, if you ordered a whiskey, which, you know, in the U.S. would have been made from corn rather than only the barley that a single malt whiskey would have been made from in Scotland, you'd have corn and wheat and other, perhaps rye. And it might have come, when you got it, you know, it might not have been brown at all. It might have been what they would have called green at the time, so it would have been clear. Like what we think of, when people talk about moonshine, corn whiskey, that tends to be what they're thinking of, is that clear, high-proof product. Because corn has, once you put those enzymes in that converts the starches into sugars, there's a lot of sugar in there, and it makes that slightly sweeter flavor that people know. But, you know, anything that you can ferment, you can distill. You can run it through the still. So the fruit that would be around that same region would have been a real candidate as well. If you had apples, you'd take that cider and turn it into applejack.
Harry was asking about the history of distilling in Wisconsin and back in the 1800s. I mean, there's a real comeback, it seems anyway, where in many communities, local spirits and making our own rum and whiskey and other adult beverages, that's made a real comeback.
Yeah, it's exciting, isn't it? I mean, 30 years ago in this country, there was a resurgence of small breweries, of craft brewing, and that came really in response to the fact that the only beers that at that point that you could get in this country were these big national brands like you know, a Coors or a Budweiser, and without saying this as if it were objective fact, those are beers that, let's say, do not show all of the wonderful variety you can get out of making beer, right? They are what they are, as they would say. And so there were people who were brewing at home who got good enough at it to realize they could make better stuff than they could get on the shelves of their local store. And they eventually were the people who became the craft brewers and then the small brewers, the micro brewers, right? And today, 30 years later, pretty much wherever you go in the United States, you can, if you're at a place where they're serving beers, there's a local beer on tap. And it's not always great. Often it's just interesting, but it's local. And that's really cool, right? It's a nice thing. And that kind of thing is starting to happen with distilling as well. Not every community has a distillery now. But in big cities, you can find several. Here in San Francisco, we've got a bunch. Within walking distance of my house, have a two breweries, three wineries, two places making mead, and a place making sake. And if I'm willing to drive about 10 minutes, depending on traffic, I can get to three distilleries. And all of them quite good, which is nuts. That's the Bay Area. So obviously that's not typical of anything, but the difference between this craft distilling upsurge and the craft brewing upsurge, I think, is that, weirdly, the national brands that you can buy of distilled spirits are quite good, right? I mean, if you're talking about just in bourbon, Jack Daniel's not a bourbon, I know, Tennessee Sour Mash, people get really kind of obsessive about the names, but American whiskeys, Jack Daniel's, Wild Turkey, Jim Beam, you buy them almost anywhere that sells spirits, and they're delicious, you know? So it's not as much of a response to what's available as it is the idea that people can actually do this and be distilling something and create something new that nobody's tried before and then sell that in a community. So I was just in Washington, D.C. a few weeks ago and talking to a distiller who's opened the first distillery in Washington, D.C. in 100 years. He's making a couple of gins. They're very good. He's a very nice guy. And it's just, you know, it's neat to have something local at a time when it feels like, everything is just a giant national brand that you buy at a Costco or something. That's something they only make here. You can only get it here. It makes it worth traveling.
Yeah. Let's go back to the phones. Bob in Madison has, I think, an answer for us regarding the origin of the word booze.
Oh, good.
Thank you. Thank you for the program. There's a bourbon museum in Bardstown, Kentucky, that has a display. Yeah, on the origin of the word. It was a brand name, just like Jim Beam or Jack Daniel's. There was a company owned by the Booze family, and all of their bottles had the name Booze, and it was such a popular brand in the early 1800s that there were thousands of Booze bottles in the frontier, and it just became a generic because it was the most common brand. Just like Kleenex or other things that have become generic terms for something. And if you go to the museum in Bardstown, you can see a collection of booze bottles.
That's cool.
That is very interesting, isn't it? Thank you, Bob. You know, we did look it up, too. Booze is a distilled version of German and English words, Bausen, and the Dutch word boozen, which means to drink excessively or to get drunk. So maybe there was a brand name of booze based on, you know, that word origin.
See, this is the risks of etymology. You start to, it's hard to know who is who's telling the truth and who's telling the tall tale.
Yeah. All right. Thanks very much, Bob. Let's go to Joanne in Menominee next. Hello, Joanne.
Oh, hi, it's Joan.
I'm sorry, Joan.
That's okay. This program is fascinating. my question is that if you know, I don't know how to word this exactly, but the physiology, why some people process different alcohols in different ways. For example, I'll just do something personally. I can drink a hard alcohol, whiskey, rum, all those things, with very little effect until I really get, you know, if I'm drinking a lot. And this is why I don't drink a whole lot. But beer and wine especially, one glass, a half a beer, I'm dancing on tables. So why is that, that some things affect people differently?
Well, see, the reason I'm hesitating is that my first instinct answer makes me sound like a jerk, because the answer, at least as far as scientists would tell you now, is they don't. And not meaning to be disrespectful of your experience, dancing on a table after half a beer seems like for a pretty good time.
Mm-hmm.
But I will say that what that would require, right, if you just think about mechanisms for a second, is that there is some other psychoactive chemical in drinks that could make you feel different depending on what you were drinking. Tequila makes me aggressive, gin makes me morose, right? But nobody's ever been able to identify anything other than the ethanol as a thing that has an effect on people. Now, what social scientists will tell you is that what influences your behavior when you are drinking is something called an expectancy. It's our social learning about what our cultural rituals and our personal history and seeing our parents drink if they drank in front of us, what all those things tell us about how people behave when they are drinking. And those can have a profound effect on whether you are, when you're drinking, whether you get sad or whether you get voluble or whether you get promiscuous or whether you're dancing with beer but having not feeling or at least not manifesting any effects if you have a glass of whiskey. A great story from history that gets at this is the story of absinthe, which is a sort of licorice-flavored drink popular in the in Europe, especially in the, I guess, early 1800s. I think I have that year timing right, that it was famous as a drink of artists and poets. It's this herbal, really strong stuff. And at the time, people thought that if you drank absinthe, basically it would turn you into an epileptic murderer, that it would give you seizures and you'd want to kill people, you'd go crazy. And they thought that's because one of the ingredients, it's all botanicals, it's all plants, was wormwood. And wormwood has in it a molecule called thujone. Thujone in high enough amounts is a hallucinogen. It'll make you see things, you know, like LSD does. And they thought, oh, well, it's the thujone, it's the wormwood and the absinthe. People are going crazy. We have to ban this stuff. And most of the world banned absinthe containing wormwood. So it's why anisets like Pernod arose, because they were supposed to replace this dangerous, crazy stuff, absinthe, in cocktails. Well, a few years ago, a researcher named Ted Breaux went back and actually did analyses of pre-ban absinthe to try to figure out, well, was there enough thujone in these things to actually make people go insane? And, of course, what he found is no. I mean, it was subclinical levels. There wasn't anywhere near enough thujone to make anybody feel any effects. What there was a huge amount of ethanol, a ton of alcohol. They were really, really strong, and people were really drinking a lot of them, so they were just getting blitzed. And that's why people who were drinking absinthe were going kind of nutty to the extent that they were. It was a mistake. So is it possible that there are other things in different alcohols that have a psychoactive effect? I mean, sure, but nobody's found them. Nobody, there's no evidence for that right now.
Very interesting. Thank you very much, Joan, for sharing that. I sometimes think that if I have a glass of wine, it's going to put me to sleep, like pronto, and that's the only drink or cocktail or that would do that to me. And you're saying maybe that's not the case, that it's just how I'm feeling on that night that I had that glass of wine.
Yeah, I mean, that's what the state of the research shows. Is it possible that I'll get proved wrong with something that gets published at the big meeting of alcohol researchers that's happening in Seattle right now? Sure. But yeah, like what you bring to the bar basically is what you go home with in some senses.
Yeah, so what's this meeting of alcohol researchers gonna find out this that's going on right now?
You know, I'm following presentations at a distance like everyone else is. I'm sure if you're not watching the World Cup, you're watching the alcohol researchers meeting in Seattle. I know that the folks who study hangovers, for example, are having a little bit of a side get together there. So I'm going to ping them, the ones that I know, when they're done, and see if anything new came out. Because, as I say in the book, and what I've been saying since it came out, is that it is a sad fact that researchers don't really understand what causes hangovers, and they have no good notes for us on how to fix them.
Yeah, so you wrote in the book that the science of booze doesn't detract from the magic behind it. Describe the magic you're talking about.
Well, I think you know, if you're a person who drinks with, you know, with an eye toward recreation, like I have been and am, we all have stories about the moments when that was perfect, right? When you tasted something that was exquisite, or when you were sitting in a bar and with a friend, and it was a transcendent moment, and you tried something that was delicious, and it seemed like, well, this is the best thing ever, you know. Or that if you're a beer snob and you went to Belgium to visit that one monastery that makes so little perfect beer that they don't sell it anywhere except at the monastery, you went on a trip and you got to taste it and it was amazing. And we have these moments, you know, and they're so wrapped up in our personalities and our emotions and our feelings and how we perceive taste and smell, which is again wrapped up in our memories and our sense of self, that they can be perfect moments. They can be magical. It can feel like this transcends science, this transcends space and time. It connects me historically to 10,000 years of human history and 2,000 years of human technology and 150 million years of evolution. And all that is true. But for me, all of that, the way to appreciate that the most is to try to understand the science behind it and try to understand how we make it, why we make it, and how it makes us feel the way it does.
Yeah. So give us, in our final moments here, one of the most magical or memorable or amazing moments in the research for your book.
Oh, you know, I went to Scotland to talk to whiskey makers, and I love the space side. It's an area that it's a whiskey making area, and it's just beautiful. It looks like everything you would possibly want out of Scotland, with stone walls and sun dappled brooks and stuff like that. And it's just gorgeous. But I love it there, and I hope I get to go back. While I was there, I also got to go outside Edinburgh to a place called the Scotch Whiskey Research Institute, which is it's a lab, and it's run by all the different distillers as they try to do the science to understand what they make. They make this stuff. They know how to make it better than anyone in the world, in my opinion. And even they don't really know everything that's in it or how it works. So they built a lab, and I've read about this lab for 15 years, and I'd always wanted to go, and I finally talked them into letting me come visit. So to get to see the Scotch Whiskey Research Institute, to be in this place that makes this stuff that I love so much, and then see them running it through a gas chromatograph, you know, and trying to figure out, well, we all know it tastes, everybody agrees it tastes good, but why, was pretty great for me.
And just a minute to go. What's you're going to be the drink at the cocktail hour tonight for you?
You know, I have we bought a bottle of good grenadine, you know, which is supposed to be based on pomegranate juice. But if you buy the stuff kind of in a crummy store, it's really just kind of sugar and flavors. But we bought a bottle of good grenadine, so I've been working through the list of grenadine drinks with grenadine. Last night it was something called the Jack Rose, which is applejack and grenadine and lemon. And I hadn't had one in a long time because usually there's no good grenadine. It was tasty. It was all right. Let me try to perfect that recipe a little bit.
Well, I really appreciate your time. Thanks a lot for being with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Adam Rogers is the author of Proof, The Science of Booze. Thanks to Cynthia Schuster, to Christy Taylor, and to Justin Williams for producing and directing this program. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.